Hey everybody, and welcome to another Vassals of Kingsgrey podcast on Tolkien's amazing Lord of the Rings and all his associated works, so lots of spoilers, be warned. As we have reached, well, more than halfway in our book-by-book podcast, we thought we would take a break and just recap some of the amazing responses we've had on the forums at a podcast of Ice and Fire. We've had forum members such as Barrick175 and Vali really, you know, coming up with some amazing Tolkien lore and provoking some good discussions. So we thought it would be good to, you know, go back through that and have a chat about it. So joining me today, we have White Raven.
Hello. Brett on the forums. Or White Raven on the forums. Brett on the podcast.
It's always the best line when you confuse real life and your avatar, isn't it? We also have Amanda.
Amanda, middle cyclone on the forums.
And we have absurdly early in the morning from New Zealand, Tanya.
Hi, I'm silent on the forums.
Okay, so it's great you're all here, and maybe I think Peter and or Shane might join later on. So the first one we did was on book one of The Fellowship of the Rings, and one of the first comments that came up from Beric was that we had this discussion about the ring wraiths, and I had, I think, commented that I thought they were pretty sucky and not very scary, and we were like, why is this? Yeah, anyway, so Beric made the point. He says, my guess as to the strength of the ring wraiths is that Sauron is gathering his forces, so they would obviously not want to show their full strength because it's not the right time. So I'm wondering what people think of that as an excuse.
I always thought they were really scary, but then again, I read the books when I was 8, so...
But when you watch the movies, though, they do look pretty crap. I mean, all they can do is sniff hobbits, and if the hobbits hide under the roots of a tree, they don't really have much power to sort of see through that.
They might just be trying not to make a big stink. If they can just, like, stealthily get the rings without people realizing that they're out and about doing things, like flying under the radar of, like, you know, luminaries like Gandalf, they can just, like, get their thing done, get Sauron's power more secured, and then just, like, keep it moving. But
okay, so they're kind of like efficient bureaucrats. I see that. And then the next big discussion we all had, obviously, with book one is Tom Bombadil, which is, you know, does it just distract from the main plot getting going? And what is the point of Tom Bombadil? And Barrick175 also had a good point where he said that, you know, it was good to have the book grounded in stuff that existed before Sauron and before the quest, and to show that there are these elemental things that continue a sort of wider evil. So I've come around to the idea that that's quite a nice idea. But any other thoughts?
All sorts of things like... Oh, hey.
So you stopped eating your moose, Peter?
Nah. I haven't gotten my moose yet, but there's also other things like Caradhras, the mountain that's sort of sentient as well, and you got the nameless things gnawing at the roots of the world in the, underneath Moria and all those sorts of things. I'm not sure if those are referred to in the Silmarillion, but evidently a lot of those, like, older evils than Sauron around still.
Yeah, I agree. I think the problem is that things like the evils at Caradhras and Shelob are woven into the plot, whereas Tom Bombadil just seems to hold it up. And while we're on Tom Bombadil, I will fast forward through the comments to something that Peter brought up, which is that Tom Bombadil potentially had his wicked way with Goldberry. And even and even on the show notes to this, was it White Raven or was it Middle Cyclone who was like, what? So, Peter, do you want to just explain the background to that? Because that's obviously caused a lot of consternation.
Well, this is actually something I heard on the Tolkien Professor podcast. He mentioned it sort of dismissed it as well, but this is from the Adventures of Tom Bombadil. I guess this is a children's book that Tolkien wrote. I mean, I guess the whole idea of Tom Bombadil came about from a story that Tolkien used to tell to his kids, and this is like a printed version of that, I guess. So there's the passage that Tom Bombadil sort of just, well, this Goldberry is sort of like a water nymph. She tried to drown Tom like they usually do in stories, and but Tom didn't get drowned, and he just sort of wrestled Goldberry out of the stream and carried her off to be his wife, I guess.
So I think you posted the quote from the song in the forums, and I think the key line is, he caught her, held her fast, water rats went scuttering, etc., etc. And he says, you shall come under hill, never mind your mother, in her deep, weedy pool. There you'll find no lover. But it's the he caught her, held her fast bit, which I suppose is a bit dodge. And actually, while we're on controversies that Peter has raised, aka Shellfish, the golem... it's the golem eats babies line. So there is textual evidence for this, right?
I think so.
There's totally textual evidence for golem eating babies. Yeah.
Back to the thing with Goldberry, and it's strange that people always wonder, what's Tom Bombadil? What's he doing there? But nobody really asks many questions about Goldberry. She's just, like, accepted.
That's true.
In the classic Tolkien way where, like, women are always just appendages to men, I guess. No, but seriously, like, it's not a story in which there are many women who aren't there just as convenient sidekicks.
More powerful sidekicks, though.
Well, Galadriel, I suppose, being the exception, because she's the boss.
Luthien and Melian, they're all more powerful, but they are kind of, not sidekicks, I wouldn't say, but I don't know, it's kind of like the Green Hornet, where the other guy does all the work.
One thing that always bothered me was that Eowyn is so awesome and amazing and a fighter and everything, and then in the end she just settles down and marries Faramir and then stops being awesome, pretty much.
Although we don't really know what happens, do we, to Faramir and Eowyn? They just sort of live happily ever after, but for all we know, she's off killing, guarding the southern borders. I don't know.
Yeah, she became like a nurse.
Really?
I thought it. Yeah. That's somewhere that she gave up being a shield maid.
Did she?
I think it might be in your chapter coming up.
Yeah, it is in your chapter.
In my chapter?
Yeah, it's in the Houses of Healing.
Oh, Jesus. Okay, I need to get on with the reread. That's depressing. Okay, but we buy the theory then that Tom. Like, this is like the Supreme Court, not of Westeros, but of Middle Earth. Do we buy that Tom Bombadil's basically a kidnapping rapist? Is that what we're going for?
It doesn't seem like Tolkien to write something like that. Like, it doesn't seem, I don't know.
He's a kidnapping racist with good PR.
Yeah.
Exactly. If you wear a jaunty jacket and sing merry songs, people will forgive you almost everything, apparently. And yeah, I think it's pretty uncontroversial that Gollum eats babies, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we'll find out.
Okay, the next thing that I guess got a bit of discussion on the forums was, we talked a bit about the whole relationship between Sam and Frodo and Nadia being very creeped out by it. And I think there was maybe, not a misunderstanding, but there were different things that people are creeped out by. So some people think it's a very homosocial relationship, and other people are freaked out because it seems like a very class-ridden relationship. And in Nadia's mind in particular, she said it was almost like a slavishly obedient relationship, which I thought was quite interesting. I don't know what people think about that. I've always been quite a big defender, actually, of Sam Frodo. I just think it's really touching, and people just aren't used to seeing that kind of friendship expressed openly and without any kind of irony.
Yeah. I think you have to look at the context of, like, if you look at when Tolkien was writing it, not to get, like, allegorical or whatever, but just, like, male friendship and, like, the idea of your buddy in war was just, like, a thing that was so, like, glorified in, like, media and songs and everything, especially with, like, both the World War One and World War Two, like, veterans. I feel like homosexuality just wasn't, like, acknowledged in that way, and so it's, like, I don't read them as some homosexual at all as a gay person, but, I mean, there's definitely some stuff that's, like, a little, like, weird, but if you think about the fact that that's just the way a, like, strong male friendship was portrayed in some ways, that might be part of the reason that it reads weird to us now, because culturally male friendship is looked at differently now, I think.
Yeah, and actually Beric put it really nicely in the forums. He puts, and I quote, "The elements of friendship ring true because there is no political correctness concern at all, just an expression of the author's true feelings about what friendship entails. Whereas these days everyone wants to get rid of any ambiguity here, sadly, because of subconsciously macho kind of audience that can't deal with emotional complexity." And
yeah,
I think that's really well put.
Yeah. That is very well put.
But on the issue of, like, the class divide, I mean, I guess to modern ears, it does seem... I mean, sometimes Sam really is quite subservient, in fairness.
I don't really know what to say about it. I don't know much about class divisions. So, to me, they do seem like he's subservient to Frodo, but I don't see it as necessarily a bad way. It seems like he enjoys being that way.
I mean, I think, like, Eiffel made a good point on the forums where he said all of the other hobbits, apart from Sam... the ones that are in the Fellowship are basically kind of Shire equivalent of aristocrats, whereas Sam is like the gardener. So he would want to show, I think, some division between the two sets. He did.
Yeah, because, like, Mary is considered Frodo's best friend, but you'd think after reading the book that Sam would have been his best friend. But he was just his gardener.
You'd wonder why Gandalf wouldn't want to send Merry with Frodo to be his honest companion, I guess.
Well, maybe Gandalf didn't know about Merry and Sam happened to be there.
Yeah, true. Sam always happens to be overhearing shit at opportune moments, so...
Oh, he was spying on him, that's why.
Yeah, both when he was spying on Gandalf and Frodo in the Shire and at the Council of Elrond. So he's like a nosy... He's a little bit Sackville Bagginsy in some ways, Sam.
Oh, yeah.
They had like a conspiracy, though. Him and Merry and Pippin were all spying on him.
Yeah, definitely. But I don't know how much of it's conscious on the part of Tolkien or, you know, Lord Mandeville made a good point that it's probably quite ingrained, the class prejudice at the time at which he's writing. And I think the point that I was trying to make is that if Tolkien has a little bit of class, kind of he's a bit patronizing towards Sam, I think it's more forgivable here because it's all the context of when it was written. I find the Downton Abbey thing far more appalling because it really is sort of kind of from a modern perspective looking back at the past and saying, oh, wasn't this a wonderful time when you could tug your forelock and be a servant to some wonderful noble? I find that far more problematic. Ah, is Ted on the podcast? Is Eddie on?
Hello.
Hey. We're just going through some of the comments on the previous episodes and seeing like what we think of them. The next subject on book one was there's lots of chat about Glorfindel, because I think I was having this point about why doesn't Elrond send Glorfindel on the quest because he's awesome. But we came to the conclusion, I think, that it's a different Glorfindel than the one that killed the Balrog in Gondolin.
It's the same one.
I don't think it's the same.
I think it's the same one. It was Tolkien, he like said it in a letter later, like an interview or something later on, that he was reincarnated and brought back.
It's not in any of the official texts, but like Brett said, it's in a letter somewhere, and most fans think it's cool enough to like consider it canon, so they do, but some people don't agree, I guess.
Oh, so it's a reincarnated Glorfindel. Is that the...
Yeah, elves can reincarnate their bodies, but he's the only one who's died and come back to Middle-earth.
Which also sounds kick-ass, and I just still don't quite get why he wasn't sent on the quest in that case.
Probably because Elrond was too scared. Don't want to send their best fighter off. Okay, yeah, he did send his sons.
Yeah.
But Beren and Lúthien came back, right? They came back from the halls of Mandos.
Lúthien didn't die, though. She just went there to get Beren back, if I remember correctly.
But
Beren came back, so, yeah.
Okay. And then there was, I think, some like discussion about what exactly is Valinor and what is it like? Like, how should we conceive of Valinor? And Bali had made the point that it's almost like a kind of Zion where the elves in Middle-earth are exiles and suffer the hurts and pains of mortal lands and live in this diaspora.
Elves aren't really going to Valinor. They're going to Elvenhome, which is like connected to Valinor. But they don't actually live in Valinor. That's where the Ainur live, the Valar.
Ah, okay. Who are the gods, basically.
Yeah.
Kind of. Like sub-gods to
but
the one god.
But is it the Valar who send the Maiar, like Gandalf, to Middle-earth to help out?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. I'm learning so much. Yay. Oh, yeah. And then Iswin to Cumann was a bit upset as all our children of Húrin hate. I think it would be good if anyone here has read Children of Húrin and would recommend or not recommend it to someone like me who hasn't. Like, should someone read it like me? I love Lord of the Rings, but is it really a tough read or is it worth having a go at?
Did you read the Silmarillion?
I tried.
I read
I would say it's easier to read than the Silmarillion, but not quite Tolkien. Like, not quite these Tolkien works, if that makes sense.
Okay.
I haven't read it either, Bina, so don't feel bad. I've been meaning to.
Lord Mandeville called it, like, the Wikipedia of, like, lore, which is probably not good. Anything else on book one? I'm trying to think. I think the big discussion there was really Glorfindel and whether the whole Sam and Frodo relationship. Okay, so on to book two. Oh my goodness, this was a big one. Does the Balrog have wings? Who wants to say he does have wings? Let's get a debate going. Who's defending the wingness of the Balrog?
Why not? I mean, it says he has wings. I mean, there might be wings that he just can't fly. I mean, they might be just for show, like a peacock or something.
Why does every Balrog in the Silmarillion, and that we know of, died from falling from a great height?
Yeah,
but a peacock can die from falling from a great height, too.
So can a penguin.
They don't really have wings, they're all like flippers or like...
They're like birds, they're wings.
There's that scene in some battle or something where a lot of Balrogs just come flying. I don't remember where that's from. I don't know. From Moria, because that one really doesn't fly.
Heard on the Tolkien Professor podcast that one of the reasons he listed that why they don't have wings was that, like, the eagles used to live on a mountain right next to Morgoth's lair, like, because they knew that he couldn't touch them there because he had no flying forces until he met the dragons. So I guess that might be, I haven't read the Silmarillion, so it doesn't really mean much to me, but I don't know who the Lord of the Eagles was then.
I could argue for not having wings. The Balrog falls. They break the bridge, and the Balrog just falls like a dead weight, and then takes Gandalf with him. Like, if he could fly, he would just flap his wings and not fall.
Okay.
The penguin argument, penguin would fall from the bridge as well, but it would still have wings because it's a bird.
Okay, so here's the Beric 1/5 argument. He said, I actually think Balrogs have wings because in the Silmarillion, when Morgoth fights with Ungoliant after they destroyed the two trees of Valinor and stole the Silmaril, Morgoth screams so loudly that it wakes the Balrogs in the mountains, and they arrive to drive Ungoliant away, that they would not have been able to arrive there as fast had they not had wings. And they might not have been able to find them otherwise, because it would have been possible to find them had they been able to fly. Although it is true that both Balrogs, of whose death we know, died by falling down somewhere.
Oh, but there's different arguments there, because the question whether Balrogs have wings or not is not the same question as whether they can fly or not.
True.
Because I personally think they can definitely fly, because there's a couple of quotes. I posted one as well, it's from the appendix. It says, thus the dwarves rouse from sleep a thing of terror, that flying from Thangorodrim, had they hidden at the foundations of the earth since the coming of the host of the west, the Balrog of Mordor. I think there's enough quotes that show that Balrogs can fly. I don't know what that was, the one in Moria, because that one really didn't
what,
do very well.
What were Gandalf's last words before he fell down the hole? I think he said, fly, you fools. Tolkien is using the term fly as in to run away fucking quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's different when you tell people to fly than when you tell animals, like, when you tell something with wings to fly. No?
One thing I thought of when you said that you thought that they could fly, but they didn't necessarily have wings. I thought about how much of a physical creature is a Balrog? Isn't it like a spirit of fire or something like that? So does it necessarily even have a physical form that would necessarily have wings? I mean, it could be like just weightless, basically.
I feel like a lot of this, it doesn't really matter to me. Like,
then why is that you wanted to have a podcast about?
No. I mean, the fact that if Balrog did or did not have wings doesn't really matter to me. I mean, Ungoliant, if she was a Maiar like a Balrog, she was a spider. Why'd she choose a spider? Why wouldn't a Balrog just choose to be an eagle? It doesn't really matter to me, I guess. Whether or not they had wings or they could fly or not, they died from falling. Maybe those Balrogs didn't have wings. Maybe others did. Who knows? I mean, he doesn't really go into it, so it's hard to lock it down.
Maybe it's just a Jane Westerling white hips moment, although I tend to think that Tolkien does less of those than George R. R. Martin.
But I feel like if Balrogs had wings, why would you write that the shadow extended like wings instead of just saying that he had wings? Does that make sense? Am I making sense?
Yeah. That's why I don't really think it matters.
But it just does bug me in a book that's so meticulous about stuff making sense, that if they do have wings and they can fly, why doesn't he frickin' fly when he's one-to-one with Gandalf?
Yeah.
I tend to think Tolkien's not going to write something retarded, so I tend to think, therefore, that they can't fly. I mean, that's my backward induction reason why I don't think they can fly. Sorry, just all the lore masters stand in dumb silence at Bina's idiotic.
There's so many passages where it says they fly. So, like, I don't know what's up with that one. Maybe it doesn't.
Maybe it's just
Jake
Westling's wide hips. I don't know. I mean,
maybe Gandalf is distracting it or something.
Maybe the cave is too small for his wings to spread. Not to get super technical.
But it's a Balrog. It's a spiritual Balrog fire spirit constrained by logistical shit, like the width of the opening to the cave. any more thoughts on the Balrog? Or do we leave that as undecided by the Court of Middle-earth? Okay. We then got into this massive amount of feedback on what is the coolest sword name in Tolkien and then in kind of fantasy in general. And there was a lot of chat. We ended up putting a poll up, and the swords that won the poll were Excalibur and Dark Sister, so therefore nothing got into the top two from Tolkien.
What's so exciting about Dark Sister? I don't know. I'm not impressed by that.
I think maybe the person who wields Dark Sister is more impressive than the name of the sword.
That's cheating. Okay.
And as I pointed out to people, like, Excalibur just means cut steel. It's like not an exciting name of itself. But Beric175 was making the case that I don't know how you pronounce this, Anglachel? Iron of the Flaming
Anglachel.
Anglachel. Iron of the Flaming Star in Sindarin. That does sound pretty awesome.
Is that Turin Turambar's sword?
It's King Thingol's sword, and survived the fall of Doriath and was later wielded by Turin Turambar, who would use it to slay Glaurung the Golden.
I think Beleg actually had it. It was another elf in the Silmarillion. I think he got it from, maybe I'm incorrect, but I think he got it from Thingol, and then Turin stabbed Beleg with it.
Quite sure about that.
No, it's definitely like that. Beleg took it when he went to rescue Turin, but Beleg definitely had it, and then Turin got it from him.
I think Melian told him not to take it because it had like a dark heart in it or something, and then he took it and Turin ended up stabbing Beleg thinking he was somebody else, and then Turin kept it.
Yeah.
And then he ended up...
And the sword talks.
Yeah. It judges him.
Sounds like the sorting hat in Harry Potter.
Turin falls on his sword in the end. That's taken directly from the Finnish national epic of Kalevala. Tolkien just pretty much took that straight from there. And I guess also the sort of like he married his sister unbeknownst to him, and that's why he killed himself. I guess that's kind of Oedipus thing too, but it was in the Kalevala as well.
Ah, okay. And then there was some confusion and controversy about, is Durin's axe actually in Balin's tomb?
Beric's post was that the journal, the Book of Marasibul, the thing they find in Balin's tomb, that it implies that it was buried with Balin. I haven't gone back to read it, but I guess that's the argument.
Yeah, but unusually even Beric was a bit unsure, so I was just wondering if anyone had any other theories as to...
If Beric is unsure, there's probably no textual evidence to support it.
I'm obsessed because I used to know so much and I forgot all of it. Because I was so obsessed with Tolkien and the books and everything about it, and I spent all my... I also didn't have any friends or anything else exciting to do with my life. just being honest. And I was still in school, so I just had time all day and I just read Tolkien books all day and I knew everything. And now it's been such a long time. Now I have a life and now I don't know as much about Tolkien.
Yeah, but at least you knew it to forget it, where I never even knew it. So it's already... Okay, so controversy on Balin and the axe being in Balin's tomb.
Yeah, knowing Balin, it might just be some axe that he found that he thinks is Durin's axe, but, like, I don't even know how they would know it would be.
There's precedent for dwarves burying, like, cool weapons with them, because when Thorin dies, they bury Orcris with him.
Apparently the Fellowship didn't find any axe, so it was probably lost somewhere.
And they didn't open his tomb, so...
Yeah, they didn't crack open his tomb.
I mean, presumably that axe is lost to history now, because whatever carnage was caused by the fighting and, like, the Balrog.
Yeah, Moria isn't, like, exactly the most structurally sound place in the whole world.
Don't they reclaim it, though? I mean, I haven't read the Tale of Years yet, but pretty sure that they reclaim Moria, the dwarves.
You mean Peter, who said it's dwarf homework, doesn't know?
when the last Durin turns up, I think they lead all the dwarves back into Moria, like the Fourth Age or whatever.
They're like, hey, Gandalf did all the hard work for us. Let's go in there and reclaim it.
The douchiness of dwarves. Which kind of brings us neatly to the douchiness of elves. So I think this is what... I think this was the episode in which Shellfish's deep antipathy towards elves was first revealed in its full glory. So we have Vali, who was the only guy on the forums who defended the elves. And this is what he put. I'm currently listening, but I'd have to disagree with the elves, especially the singer being a dick. They obviously hold great respect for Bilbo, and that's why they rib him. They are obviously a more angelic being than the mortals, and plus they know the story that Bilbo is trying to sing about, because they were actually there. Shellfish, do you have any response?
He calls them sheep.
Is that it?
Pretty much.
But I do think it's interesting that over the course of this podcast, no matter who's joined in, like, the general anti-elf tone has remained.
Honestly, I wasn't anti-elf until I started looking at it from that perspective. And then I was like, man, these guys are assholes.
Well, I mean, they're just kind of boring, like, in a sense of, like, looking at the story. I mean, they're so perfect and beautiful and live a long time and fight better and sing better and cook better and live better and look at the stars better and...
I think if you read the Silmarillion, you get a lot more interesting sides to the whole thing. Yeah, I think in the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, elves aren't necessarily interesting.
Yeah, this definitely came out on the forums where everyone was talking about how much cooler the elves were in the Silmarillion, and that they're basically now, I think Lord Manderby called them recovered alcoholics.
Yeah, I can see that.
It bothers me that they make better weapons than the dwarves. I mean, dwarves are, like, completely focused on making things and forging stuff, and then the elves are supposedly better than them. That's not cool.
Well, what do you mean it's not cool? I mean, they just don't deal with it.
Well, they don't. They haven't earned it in any way. They're just like, oh, well, elves, we just do everything better by default.
Well, they actually got to learn from one of the Valar who was great at making things, so they kind of had a different... Well, the dwarves might have too, because he created them.
I think with the Silmarillion, you just got to keep in mind that it's the elves writing from the elf perspective, just sometimes. It's just like, it's people talking to elves, getting how elves feel about things, and so they're going to be like, we were so great at this stuff. Oh man, Feanor, what? That guy.
Yeah, it's sad that the elves that lived in Valinor created weapons. It's like, what the hell do you need these for? You got the Valar all around you, and now you're creating weapons? What are they for other than to kill other elves? I guess it's not fair, because you only really hear about the ones that do something great or terrible. So you don't get, like, farmer elf just out there in the fields working away, wondering why Galadriel doesn't give him a hand.
I think basically the feeling can be summed up by Inkaz Rain. Who wrote, Shellfish, I am totally on board with you. I hate elves, capitalized. They are sneezy and nasty. I can't stand how they're responsible to the potential destruction of Middle-earth by Sauron is so frequently, whatevs, we're off to our sparkly, beautiful, eternal lands. Good luck with the magical, evil dictator. Or not, we don't actually care.
They do actually help.
And then she put, same goes for the bloody Dúnedain. Ooh, we're descended from elves. We have automatic awesome points.
But they do help. I won't say they don't help, because they, like, take care of the north while everybody else takes care of the south. And the Dúnedain do come down and help in the war.
About 50 of them.
That's all that's left. They've been trying so hard up north.
Yeah, they only come to, like, install their king.
Yeah.
Like, you usurp the throne, actually.
No, it's his throne.
Well, no, it's not actually. I mean, he's not like a direct descendant of the King of Gondor.
He's not in that line necessarily, but he is in the line of the Numenorean kings.
Yeah, but aren't the Gondorians as well? Because, I mean, they just, after the King's Tribe, they just decided not to elect another king because they thought it would lead to more civil war. But it is the line of the Gondorian kings that is still in the Gondorian people, but it's just been dwindled and mixed.
Yeah.
Which actually brings us into, there was a whole discussion on the forums about exactly what was the nature of the antipathy between Gondor and Rohan, and do the Gondorians look down on Rohan, and if so, why? And
well, the Numenoreans were kind of imperialists. And they, colonial imperialists that were just like, let's weep at our island, just sank into the ocean, womp womp, for the ones that were, like, less shitty. Let's just go install our own little kingdom. Let's go bother Herodrim. Let's just keep causing trouble. Oh no, why does everyone hate us?
But so my question is, how much the average Gondorian, so like a Faramiri type, well maybe he's not average, your average Gondorian, how much Numenorean blood does he still have? And does it vary? Like, would Prince Imrahil still have, would he be more kind of high Gondorian than the average? I don't know how it works.
Yeah, I think he is, and it's sort of said that Denethor is kind of like an exception, that he sort of has more of the blood or the sort of presence of a Numenorean than his fathers have. Like, said that he's, Pippin says that he seemed more like Aragorn than Boromir to him. And
yeah,
I guess
that he looks more like a wizard than Gandalf does.
Yeah. I thought that went for Faramir as well.
Faramir has, like, Gandalf-y type elements, doesn't he?
Isn't Prince Imrahil, I've been... isn't Prison Moral the most awesome character that they don't go into?
Totally agreed. Totally agreed. I want like a Duncan Egg book just about.
I was actually quite disappointed they didn't have a guy who looked like him in the film.
But we never see him to know his douchey side. Maybe if we got to know him, he'd just turn out to have feet of clay.
He's Ramsay Snow.
Well, blood.
He's Ramsay Snow?
Oh, no, he's not. We don't know. Ramsay Snow is a good warrior, apparently. Well, in his own way.
Ramsay Snow's not a good warrior, is he, in Song of Ice and Fire? We've got no evidence of that.
He's a good fighter, but not necessarily in, like, a knightly way.
No, he's like a brute. I mean, was it Bruce who said that he uses a sword like a butcher's cleaver or something like that?
Yeah.
He has no skill, he just has, like, savagery and brutality.
But he wasn't a bad fighter, he just had a different style. And we digress.
And we digress. Okay, so other comments on this episode. I think there was a lot of appreciation for Shellfish's phrase about getting stabbed with needle and exotic things, which I feel has become a running joke. And I think that was kind of it on book two. So then, on to book three. Okay, so the first bit of discussion on book three was, I think we talked a little bit about what was the correct point at which to split the two books, and the pros and cons of having Boromir's death in book three rather than as a climax to Fellowship of the Rings. And I think Beric was definitely on the argument that it should have finished book two. But then how far of that is kind of influenced by the way it's handled in the movie, which is actually pretty powerful.
I listened to the Tolkien Professor podcast on this just to see what he had to say about it. And he likes the way they do it in the movie, obviously. But he says in the book, the reason why he did it is because that Boromir's fall is when the Fellowship ended. And that's when that book ended. And then the next one, it's like the Fellowship is no longer together. Boromir's obviously not doing so hot. But that was when the Fellowship broke, and that's why that book ended that way. That's his theory anyway.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay.
It definitely seems like Tolkien to keep that kind of structure in there and to pay more attention to that than to how...
Good writing.
Yeah.
And Beric also made like quite a cool point that the death of Boromir had a lot of Frankish influences, notably from the Song of Roland. The idea that the pagans slaughter him, that he blows a horn, which in Song of Roland is called an oliphant. So, and then, okay, so here's the thing. Like, there was lots of discussion of where did the orcs come from and who bred them and what are the exact mechanics of that. So Beric put like a whole bunch of detail down on the forums.
I heard the Tolkien professor talk about it, and he seemed to suggest that people be they were sort of false breeding orcs with humans.
Do we ever see any female orcs? They're just
no. They're probably too busy having babies.
I wonder if orcs are immortal. I don't really know. I don't know if the text actually ever clarifies it. But like some of those orcs in Mordor, could they have been around for the first age? I don't really know how that works. So I've always wondered if, like, some of the orcs were like, oh, I remember this guy. I'm out of here. Or something like that. Because they don't really go into it.
Very long memories. Like, in the Hobbit, they talk about, they recognize the elven blades that they carry, the Orcrist and Glamdring. And right. I think they talk about some ancient events in, like, Ciri Tungol, some of them do. So they definitely have, like, very long memories, longer than you might expect from such a, like, barbaric culture.
It also makes them far more, not intelligent is the wrong word, but sensible in the exact English meaning of that word. Because in the movies, like, the orcs come across as these kind of thuggish, petty, rather dumb things, but... The idea of them being, you know, in Tolkien, anything that's very long-lived, like the elves, tends to be, you know, have a very, like, deep and sensitive perspective to what's going on. And I guess the orcs must also fall into that category then, like, be perceptive about what's happening. They're not just dumb robo-warriors, is what I'm trying to say then, presumably.
They're cowardly and they have mean ambition in the sense that they want small, greedy things.
Amanda, it sounds like you're talking through chainmail.
No! The orcs just want, like, mean, greedy, small things as a people. I don't know that they're robo-warriors, but I feel like since Sauron has, like, the will to dominate, he can just, like, dominate them to do what he wants, so they'll, like, complain a lot while they're doing it, possibly.
I think they're not actually sort of, like, very, like, barbaric, like, in the, I guess, traditional sense of the word. They don't have this very primitive culture. They are actually quite advanced. I think that kind of some of Tolkien's views have might have seeped in as allegory there. That they're sort of, they're kind of like bureaucrats actually, because in Kirithungol, when they capture them, they talk about like how every article they find must be catalogued and like sent upwards or something like that. And they also have this like industrial forges in Isengard and all that, so they're not like savages, but they're sort of cruel and mean. And I mean, I guess there's been this trend of orcs in fantasy lately that they're sort of these hut-dwelling savages, basically, that can't make much of anything. And I guess Tolkien's view wasn't quite the same.
We should start playing this campaign. Orcs are people too.
I think it's interesting that we never see any elven children, and it makes me wonder if the elves have just given up breeding, because you'd think there'd be more of them around, being that they live forever.
Yeah, but there's no elf fornication anymore, is there?
I don't know, that's what I'm asking. Did they give up, or they were like, nah, we don't need it anymore? Because orcs, they just sit there and breed and breed and breed, and if they live forever, that's why there's so goddamn many of them.
I read somewhere that that elves only choose to have children in times of peace and all of that. So maybe they just don't want to have kids while Sauron is around?
Maybe.
Ooh, okay. It's too dark a world to raise children in. I can see
that is poor military planning. Like, oh, we might have to go to war. Let's not make any more people.
So there's, like, no indication of on the ages of the elves. Like, I get the impression that Arwen might be relatively young, younger than Eladin and Elrohir. But I guess when she met Aragorn, she was already pretty old by then.
How old is Arwen meant to be, then?
It might say in the appendices with the whole Aragorn meeting her thing, but I don't remember.
We'll wait for Beric to let us know. Okay, and then there were kind of three things going on the forums. Like, what was the origin of the orcs? What was the origin of the Uruk-hai? And what is the kind of nature of trolls? So on the Uruk-hai, that's a bit more clear-cut, isn't it? Because they were bred in, is it the Third Age?
Arwen was 2,710 years old when she met Aragorn.
Wow.
There you go.
Okay.
Cradle robber.
Cougar. Arwen was the original cougar. Okay, so there was some chat about Uruk-hai, who were created by Sauron. Are Azog and Bolg Uruk-hai, or are they orcs?
They're orcs. I'm pretty sure they're orcs.
Okay.
Just
a word for goblin or something like that.
Yeah, orcs a word for goblin, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are references to Uruks from Mordor before Saruman, but Saruman sort of bred the Uruk-hai, and they are half man, half orc.
And they're shorter than orcs, aren't they? That's how you can tell them apart.
No, they're taller than normal orcs, but they're shorter than men.
Ah, okay. And then trolls. And Beric puts, as far as trolls are concerned, they were created out of an unnamed substance to mock the Ents. And all would turn to stone except for the Olokai, which were sun-resistant and more intelligent because Sauron knew how to improve on previous creations of Morgoth, and they spoke the black speech of Mordor. Wow, troll sun, awesome. Why do we not see any trolls in Lord of the Rings?
We see one.
Yeah, but, like, why aren't they? They seem...
There are some in Moria when they're chasing them. I mean, when they're in the Tomb of Balin, when the first sort of wave hits the door, you see like a troll like come in and Frodo stabs it, and the troll runs away. And when they're running from the Balrog, there's like a chamber with like deep pits in between the goblins and the fellowship, and then a bunch of trolls come up and they throw like bridges over the gaps so they can pursue them. So we see them, like, briefly there, but we don't see them fight or anything.
Okay.
I think they're actually doing the knocking down the gates of Minas Tirith, too. They're the ones using the battering ram.
Yeah, those are Olokai.
Okay. And are they Olokai, then? Because they're the sun-resistant ones. Yeah. Okay.
So are the Olokai half-human, then?
Good question. I don't know.
If you think, like, the creation of the Uruk-hai was bad, well...
Yeah, let's have some troll half-breeds. So my question is do we know, like, the inventory? So is it the case that, like, in Middle-earth, if there were, say, hypothetically 10,000 orcs, would there be 1,000 trolls? Like, what are the ratios here?
I know when I play Battle for Middle-earth, you make a lot more orcs than you can trolls.
Is that canon? A video game's canon? I love it.
Absolutely. Had New Line right on the box.
If anyone knows that, that's the kind of geeky shit that I would love to know. I'd love to know how many of these different things there are.
Well, definitely not canon, because I think they have, like, dwarves riding little dragons, so...
Maybe not.
Yeah,
fire drake.
Sorry, Peter.
There might be the trolls that they're sort of more savage and more like animalistic. They're more like beasts than orcs because in the Hobbit you see the trolls just sort of hanging out in the wilderness, like and it isn't treated as that big of a deal. And in the Fellowship of the Ring, in the Shadow of the Past, Gandalf is talking about like trolls are abroad, armed with dreadful weapons or something like that. So they aren't necessarily part of the armies at this point, so they're just sort of roaming about, I guess.
Okay, so more like sort of wild creatures, uncorralled.
Yeah, I guess they are sort of captured or not, or driven to war when the war comes.
Okay.
Just like the poor Easterlings.
Okay, and then Beric did this like one point which I find really interesting. He said, it's interesting that in the war against Sauron in the Second Age during the Last Alliance, in the last chapter of the Silmarillion, apparently it says that all living creatures except the elves, and even individual creatures such as birds, fought on both sides, which would imply that there would have been some good orcs at some point, and indeed some good trolls, which implies that they can make like a moral choice to on which side to fight. So they really aren't these dumb characters that just all blindly follow Saruman or Sauron.
They follow him because they think he's going to win.
But that makes them bright, right? Like, you know, pick the side that's going to win. But it's just a level of intelligence and sort of moral choice that I just didn't assume they had, really. And in which case, why would Gandalf or someone not have gone off? I mean, you've got this huge mofo army. Why wouldn't Gandalf or someone try and ask them to switch sides, or some of them, persuade them to fight on that side?
Well, that all happened in the East, and we don't read about it.
Blue Lizards were trying to do that. But I feel like they were more focused on, like, the Heracrim and stuff.
I just feel like if orcs are moral creatures, then it's not as funny for, like, Legolas and Gimli to be, oh, I've killed 23, I've killed 24. I mean, these aren't just, you know, cannon fodder. They're real people who can make a choice.
They are cannon fodder. Sauron does control them to some extent, because when he, like, turns his eye away from them, they all just freak out and start running around crazy. So he does have some control over them. However he does that, I don't know.
Sorry, any more on orcs and orcs as cannon fodder?
I think they're hero fodder, not cannon fodder.
Hero fodder. That implies that you think Legolas is a hero.
Yeah, he might be.
Ugh. Ugh. Oh, okay, so this is the first point of real interesting stuff. The nature of the Palantiri, which we had started to say, are they a means to project yourself? And Beric seemed very clear that they were just seeing stones for communication, and that they couldn't, because, you know, there was some chat about how come Saruman's so far from Orthanc just on the eve of battle, and then we were saying maybe he was projecting himself into the forest.
After reading the rest of this trilogy, they do explain that they're just for seeing, and they can't show lies, but Sauron can show things that aren't necessarily a lie, but they're not full truths. Like, he showed the corsairs coming in, but he didn't show the part where Aragorn raises the sails, which he probably didn't even know at that point, so...
Can you see into the future with that thing, or is it just the present? Because I guess they might be sort of interpreted as prophecies, like Pippin saw that sees the tree, the white tree of Gondor and all that, but I guess it's always there, and I guess the ships could have been already moving at that point, but they don't really see into the future at any time, do they?
Gandalf does talk about seeing into the past and trying to see Fëanor creating them, so I don't really know about the future past thing, but I know they don't project anything, they're just seeing stones.
Sauron has sort of destroyed Denethor's mind, or like depressed him so much, like would he just have shown all his armies everywhere without showing anything good, or could he have shown like Minas Tirith in ruins or something like that?
I think he just showed his incredibly vast army, and then showed him the corsairs of Umbar coming up the river, and Denethor just, they were already getting whooped, and he was worried.
And in fairness to Denethor, I mean, we can discuss this in the next podcast, the odds are against him, and for him to despair at those odds is actually the rational conclusion. For people like, you know, Aragorn and all those guys to see these terrible odds and think, fuck it, we're going to carry on anyway. I mean, that's the irrational response, isn't it?
Because
time and again, the Fellowship, like, this is certain doom, we're riding to certain doom. I mean, that's not really the result of a healthy...
But they ride there. They don't burn themselves. Like,
oh, yeah. I mean, he does then go because...
He just did nothing. He just decided, oh, we're going to lose, so I'm just going to kill myself. It's like, just do something.
This was after Rexy throwing his son's life away.
Yeah, also true. Also not good. Okay, so maybe my better example would have been Saruman. Like, Saruman using the Palantir to see Sauron's amazing forces and making the rational choice to ally with Sauron and try and get whatever crumbs he could and eventually try and control him, I think is a much more rational response than, oh, one does not simply walk into Mordor with two hobbits, you know.
Oh, wait, I thought of something about that last thing. It's just meant to be funny, though. He should have gone out to the front of his armies and gone down in a blaze of glory instead of just a blaze. Edit that, make it sound better. Thank you.
Oh, and then we talked a bit about the Battle of Helm's Deep. And we said that it was interesting how in the movie they changed it to make Theoden kind of have a moment of doubt, and then Aragorn has to persuade him to ride out one last time, whereas in the book he has much more resolve. And I think I, and maybe you, Amanda, but certainly Tanya, didn't like that because it made him seem more vacillating. And Beric made the point that he actually liked the change because it was more of a parallel to Denethor, because they both were prey to pessimism, but Theoden was able to overcome it.
Yeah, I agree. Something I said earlier about also how Theoden and Treebeard both sort of just go to war from the first time they're asked, that they don't have to be persuaded at all, or that they don't have any doubts. I feel it's much more compelling that they actually do have doubts and sort of overcome them and have some character growth there. I think that's more interesting. It seems too easy if they just sort of go with Gandalf right away. I mean, the Treebeard stuff obviously was bad, but the Theoden, I like it in the movies.
Well, within the book, Aragorn walked up. He's like, hey, dude, look at the sword. And he's like, okay, we're following him. In the movie, he hadn't seen his sword, so he had to give him a pep talk.
And then the other thing that got a bit of discussion in this part of the book was the voice of Saruman, and we'd had a bit of discussion about how would Theoden have been tempted by Saruman again if Éomer hadn't chipped in and sort of broken the trance. And I think there was a lot of agreement on the boards that basically Theoden might have been wavering until Éomer broke the spell, which I kind of agree with.
It's strange he didn't do that in the film.
Well, they don't show it in the film, do they? Really?
In the extended edition, really.
Yeah, true.
Well, he does sort of, kind of, the first words he said, it shows him being in some difficulty with the power of the voice, but he overcomes it more quickly than in the book.
Okay, and then we have Vali. So I had basically said it's absolutely freaking absurd that in the midst of battle at Helm Deep, that Aragorn just goes and has a bit of jaunty banter with the orc, where he's like outnumbered 10,000 to one, and he's like, I think you should surrender, we're going to come and kick your ass. And Vali disagrees. I disagree with calling Aragorn's parley absurd. I think it plays with a greater theme of hope without promise that goes through these books. When the battle looks dire, Aragorn is basically saying, who knows what the sun may bring, utter defeat or salvation for the men. No one knows. I think this is an important scene in the book, and the sunrise scene in the movie was very moving. So who agrees that Aragorn's parley makes sense?
I like it, but I don't think it's very like you said on the episode, that would they even hear what they're saying in the midst of battle? It's not very realistic, but these are fantasy books after all, so I like the scene, but I don't know if it makes sense.
He really should have just held his sword over the wall so they would have seen it and ran away.
Yeah, and that was kind of it on book three. Any other comments on book three?
Not really. I still think the parley's a little absurd, but whatever.
I mean, it's funny, and it's one of the rare examples of Aragorn being funny, as we discussed on that podcast. So.
And I do like when Aragorn says it, the men are like, oh, should we leave? And it's the orcs that are like, no, we're fighting. We're the fighting Uruk-hai. It's what we do. It's what we were bred for.
It sounds like something their strength could tell them to do. So if you're feeling a bit of doubt, recite this mantra. You're the fighting Uruk-hai. Yeah, we're the fighting Uruk-hai.
So moving on to the fourth podcast, Lord of the Rings Book 4, The Journey to Mordor. And the first point of discussion here was, who was it who was calling Sam whiny? Was that you, White Raven?
Absolutely.
A lot of people like, Sam isn't whiny and negative. He's always being positive and trying to keep Frodo's spirits up. So is winter coming an alias? We're very much of a mind that you were very harsh on Sam. So what do you have to say for yourself, Rhett?
Those folk need to go back and read the book.
Ooh.
I do think he is like a great hero of the story, but he's just so whiny. It's like Sam Tarly. He's so whiny. It's like, get over it. Aragorn doesn't bitch that he has to go into battle. Neither does Gimli or Legolas. They just do it. I just don't like characters that whine a lot.
Yeah, but they've had a little bit more experience with these sorts of things than Sam.
He's a gardener. It's not in his job description to go up a mountain and destroy a ring.
Still think he's whiny.
Oh, dear. To quote, is winter coming? The quest would have failed if it weren't for Sam bearing the ring and literally carrying Frodo up the mountain! Exclamation mark.
bitching the whole way.
Okay, then Beric obviously came in with a lore, and okay, so we've had some discussion about what exactly is the magic in the Dead Marshes, and Beric says it's been left unexplained. So how do we feel about that? I don't mind ambiguous stuff.
I don't mind it.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like necromancy, so I guess that would be Saruman's or the Ringwraith. So
yeah.
I guess Sauron might have wanted to sort of defile the remains of the elves and the Numenoreans who fought against him in the last war.
So here's something that I'm not sure I agree with, actually. So Beric argues that the magic in A Song of Ice and Fire follows stricter rules than the magic in Lord of the Rings. And that's not necessarily what I like about magical elements. In general, I prefer not knowing the trick behind the curtain because it preserves the awe that the trick inspires. So those of you who've read, like, the Silmarillion and stuff, do you think the magic is more... I always thought the magic was quite ambiguous in Game of Thrones and Song of Ice and Fire because you never quite know whether it's a misread prophecy or what really is going on.
We don't even know if magic is real in A Song of Ice and Fire, other than Melisandre making shadow babies, really. I don't know.
Beric.
And people bringing people back from the dead?
Yeah. But there's no, like, rhyme or reason as to why that's happening. There could be a consistent system, but we don't know what it is.
Well, I'm certainly sure George R. R. Martin doesn't know what it is either. Okay. So, I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see, Beric, if you're listening, like, to just go into that point a little more, because I think it is quite interesting, like, the nature of magic in both books. And, yeah, we were talking about what is the nature of Shelob and the death of Shelob, and does she just, like, starve and stuff? So there's a lot of chat of that on the forum.
I actually have something about that. Like, we were wondering if they knew what, if Shelob was there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know why I didn't think of it. Like, Cirith Ungol actually means, like, spider's cleft or something like that, or spider's pass. So they knew there was a spider there, and it was dangerous.
That's amazingly literal of you. You're, like, the honorary guardian for today's podcast. But just because it's called Spider's Pass doesn't mean that there's still a spider.
Oh, there just happens to be a giant spider up there? I want to say somebody knew.
No, but lots of these names, and especially in the world of Tolkien, signal what used to happen in a place, and it may have fallen out of... You know, if there was a magic spider there for, like, centuries, and then the spider got killed, probably still call it Spider's Pass.
It'd probably get a new name, like Spider's Bane Pass or something like that. When big things happen in Tolkien, they get new names. That's why the Silmarillion sucks to read.
Minus Ithil became Minus Morgul, or Minas Morgul.
True. Okay, so that was their bad then. Oliphants. Lots of love for the Oliphants. Apparently, you can only kill an Oliphant, or a Mumakil, as the Haradrim call them, by shooting them with an arrow in the eye.
Heavily armored.
But do they have to be armored? Maybe their skin, their hide is just thick. I think Beric is saying they're just basically invulnerable apart from in the eye.
I guess. I mean, Shelob couldn't be pierced except for by her own weight killing herself. Why not a giant elephant?
I found that whole thing about Shelob just voluntarily impaling herself rather convenient.
Well, I don't know. She could have been maybe... Aragorn was there with his sword. He could have maybe done something.
Oh, but, Jesus Christ, boys. What is it today with Aragorn? You've, like, deflected your attention from Legolas to Aragorn and his sword. It's so mean. You're such bullies.
Well, I mean, Aragorn and his sword. I said it could have killed Shelob. Sam cuts off one of Shelob's arms or one of the claws with the sting, so I guess he could have done more than just, like, did they actually body Shelob? Because I assume that the claw is made of about as hard a material as her body.
It's like Aliens. He should have picked that up and stabbed her with it.
He should have used his palantir to look into the future and watch Alien.
Sam didn't have a palantir.
Pippin had a palantir, though. He could have helped his mate out. So, and then the final thing is Faramir. Because basically, I had been in Faramir love. Apparently, there are some people out there, including Beric, who think that Faramir is too good to be true. And that if someone as wise and noble as Gandalf knows better than to go near the ring because he's so scared of being tempted by it, then isn't it just inconsistent and undermining to the concept of the ring that Faramir can go kind of be so near it and shrug it off as if it's nothing? So does anyone have any sympathy with that?
He never actually held it in his hand. It might have been a different story if he, like, saw it and actually had it.
Actually, that's true. Does Frodo doesn't actually ever take it out and show it to him, does he, like he does in the movie, or not?
They just talk about it.
Gotta agree with Beric here. I mean, again, I think it's a little too easy.
I don't remember where I heard this, but somebody made the argument that Faramir wouldn't have been a good vessel for the ring, so it didn't try to tempt him.
Yeah, we made that point on the podcast.
Oh, is that on the podcast? Oh,
yeah.
I don't know. I guess I should listen to the podcast after we tape them.
In fact, I think you made that point.
Yeah.
A bit of false modesty. Someone made this awesome point.
It was so brilliant. I don't know why nobody else thought of it.
But I think it's right. I mean, I think we came to the kind of conclusion that the ring chooses the path of least resistance to evil power, and Faramir would have just been harder to corrupt.
Well, it was already headed right where he wanted it, kind of.
Yeah, so why jump to Faramir when you've got a little hobbit munchkin that's taking you right into Mordor anyways? Okay.
Oh, and back to Shelob speaking. Remember that was on there somewhere?
Yeah, does Shelob speak?
She does to Gollum. I'm guessing they're not using hand gestures to talk about what they're doing.
Well, what I find weird is, like, it's just something it's kind of silly about a massive talking spider.
Well, between the Hobbit... Go ahead, Peter.
It's not what you thought about the spider speaking in the second Hobbit movie.
They only talked when he was wearing the ring. Is that right?
Yeah.
Like, he could only understand him when he was wearing the ring. I like that, because it makes some sense.
I thought it was good. I mean, I was kind of dreading that beforehand, because I think that talking animals are kind of silly. Like, they just make it seem like a kid's show or something like that. And I was glad that the wargs or the eagles didn't speak in the first Hobbit movie. But when the spiders did in the second one, I didn't mind, because it was pretty well done.
I don't even think Tolkien liked talking animals, because when he wrote Lord of the Rings, is there any real talking animals in this?
No, I guess he got over that, but isn't it a Silmarillion that's like Hurin the Hound or something like that? And
he's Huon. Maya. Yeah, he's a Maia, and he can only talk three times.
So he better choose him carefully. Imagine if he had to talk to someone who's hard of hearing.
He's like, shit, use up another one.
I don't know, I just find the idea of Gollum and Shelob having this little, like, tete-a-tete conversation in her weird lair, like, really weird to think about. I never really thought about what that conversation probably would have been like.
Well, I assume they had to talk, though. Because you can't just see Gollum pointing and then, like, holding his hand and, like, hobbits over there.
I'm kind of inclined to think that maybe she might have some, like, mind control thing that she could, like, project her thoughts into Gollum's head or something like that. I don't base this on anything, but that might seem, like, less stupid than the talking thing.
Ugh. Why not?
The next thing that caused Lodra's discussion was, did we really spend enough time talking about which towers are the two towers? So maybe we need to do that now. And Beric was saying, is it Barad-dûr and Orthanc, as in the movie? Or Orthanc and Cirith Ungol? Or Orthanc and Minas Ithil/Morgul?
I think you can make your own decision about that, because Tolkien sort of was forced to give the three books names, because he thought of it as one book. He just had to give them names for the publisher. So I guess you can make up your own mind for the two towers.
I think he originally wanted to call it The Treason of Isengard, but he thought that gave away too much or something like that.
Well, The Treason of Isengard is kind of the name of the individual book of book four. Like, book three is The Treason of Isengard. And book four is The Journey to Mordor, like within...
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
And I am off base, and I am sorry.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if that was Tolkien giving those names. It's just that maybe people subsequently, like publishers, gave each individual book a name, just for chapter listings.
Maybe he should have just called it A Shitload of Towers. And they could use, like, little expletives so they don't actually have to say shit.
This is what Is Winter Coming says. Nobody brought this up on the podcast, and I was curious what everyone else thought about how Tolkien split up the two towers, with book three covering Rohan, Aragorn, Legolas, Gimli, etc., and book four focusing solely on Sam and Frodo. I think some of the negativity directed towards the Sam Frodo chapters is because they come after all of the events that have already happened in Rohan, and now you're going back to the events immediately after the Fellowship, and you feel like you're starting over again on the journey. So should the book have been distributed evenly like the movie? Thoughts, people?
I'm looking this into this, and I don't know that if there is a Two Towers combined reread, like Beast Dance style reread, so it would be interesting to see if in that, like, community they've made one.
Oh my god, we should totally make one up if no one has. That'd be awesome.
Maybe when Tolkien was writing it, he was like, who the hell's ever going to want to read about Frodo and Sam walking to Mordor? I'll just put that in a separate book so they can skip it if they want.
Yeah, in all honesty, if there was a book of Beast Dance where you could just skip... Oh, anyway, I won't get into that. But you could have, like, a dawnless book, and I'd be quite happy.
Yeah, I don't know about, because in the movies, when they are interwoven with the Rohan stuff, I'm still not a big fan of those scenes with Sam and Frodo, so I don't know how much it helps to have them interwoven like that.
But at least it gives you a pause for breath. I felt like some of those scenes in the movie with the battles are so, like, you know, you're on the edge of your seat, the battle's happening, and it is nice to then just sit back a little bit and have a Sam and Frodo pause for breath and munch popcorn.
I think in the movie they break it up like that, obviously, because it does make the story more coherent, but it also gives Rohan time to move to a different position without being right there. Like, you go to Sam and Frodo, then you come back, oh, this is what the Rohirrim are doing. And it's not like, because in the book, it's like, then they went here, and then they went here, and then they did this, and then they did that, and then they went here. And in the movie, you can't just, like, and now they're walking, and then cut to the next scene and have them arriving. You kind of need, like, an in-between scene, and that's what they use the Sam and Frodo to do.
I mean, right. I personally think it all should have been interwoven. I think that's the one, and not the one, it's one of the major innovations the movie makes, which I really like. I think it just adds, it spreads narrative momentum evenly through everything. And also, because it's fun to have all the battles, and it's fun to have Helm's Deep, and it's exciting, but it just keeps in your mind focused always that the reason we're doing all this is because of the ring. So it just feels like we lose sight of the ring for too long otherwise. So I think that was the end of the feedback on four. Any other comments? Any other kind of burning things that you all wanted to say that I edited out rudely?
Burning things? Like Denethor?
But I'm Denethor. Yeah, I teed it up for you nicely there, White Raven.
Appreciate it.
It's a comedy double act if ever there was one.
Well, I guess I could say that it's kind of a surprise and a positive surprise to see how this has sort of sprang up, this whole, like, Lord of the Rings be okay thing, because in the beginning we were planning to do just one episode, and now it's the fifth episode, or...
But we're doing an episode not even on a book.
Yeah, and the response has been great as well, so thanks for commenting on the threads and keep doing it, I guess.
I just felt that the quality of the response from people like Beric and Varley and this Winter Coming and all the people who commented was just so detailed and supported by text that it deserved acknowledgement. And even if not like raising a point against it, just airing it on the podcast so that people who maybe listen to the podcast but haven't been on the forum should see the points that are being made. And also kind of a little bit of a kind of advertisement to sort of point them towards the forums, because there are good comments on there. And if you like your Tolkien lore, it's definitely worth checking out. So yeah, thank you to everybody who has responded. And thank you to all the various podcasters, not all of whom are here today, for taking part, because there is a lot of homework. And there's a lot of preparation that goes into them. But I hope it's still fun for everyone to continue. So with that, I suppose it's a goodbye from the Vassal Kingsgrave. Have a great weekend.
Bye.
Bye. Yeah, I'm going to title my summary as God damn it, Denethor, you had one job.
Oh, hello.
Love it. I can't wait for the moment for Amin to destroy our podcast because you hating on Dawn.
I'm not editing out that I hate Dawn just to please Amin, because he's wrong. I might edit that. I keep trying to lure Beric onto, as if we're having this whole podcast episode that's just about talking about stuff he's posted. And even that couldn't get him on the podcast.
I think he's secretly someone famous like Stephen Colbert, or maybe the Tolkien professor, and he doesn't want to out himself.
Well, you cut out my sort of semi-psychotic thing about how it would have been funny if the elves, not the elves, the ants, Thor about Sauron. That wasn't in the podcast. I was kind of really hurt by that.
Oh,
they're included in this one.
I really wanna tell you I'm sorry.
Elves are assholes.